Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 72 of Confessions of a Market Maker. I'm your co-host, Ray, a.k.a. All Day Ray, a.k.a. Larry Zonka, and I'm joined here by my affable co-host, former market maker, 20 years and current day retail trader, a man, if he wasn't too busy chasing skirts, he could have played football for our guest here today, a legend of House Street. I'm talking about VWAP Trader 1, JJ. How's it going, man?
Good, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing good, doing good. And our guest today is a former NFL football coach and current television sports analyst. He's won 3 Super Bowls, and at the point of his first head coach hire, he was the youngest ever to assume that role. I am talking about the man who made an appearance on the greatest TV show of all time. Of course, I'm talking about the man genius, Eric Mangini. Coach, how's it going?
It's good. I was hoping you're going to throw a few more AKAs in there with my name.
You know? Oh, well, I think you got one of the best AKAs, man, genius. Just amazing, man. That was such a classic moment in TV history, in my opinion, your appearance on The Sopranos. Coach, just tell us what that day on set was like.
Well, first of all, I was a huge fan of the show. I watched it with my wife, and it started, I think, when we were in New England. And I loved it. And then I was on a bus ride coming back from a Golden Gloves tournament. And I get this phone call and the person says, you know, producer from The Sopranos, would you like to be on it? And I'm thinking, come on, this can't be real. Who, you know, I thought someone was giving me a hard time. They said, no, seriously, we want you to be on it. I'm like, yeah, I would love to be on it. And so we go down to the set and we're in the scene, we're in Vesuvio's. And I remember just being in awe of the environment, and then appreciating the level of detail. We were there for 8 hours.
Oh, wow.
Filming the episode, and we were on for maybe 2 or 3 seconds, and you know, having conversations and having to adjust the script, because originally I was supposed to be friends with Tony, but. Okay. They said it probably isn't a good idea because people will be angry about that. And I thought, the TV show, why would anybody be angry about that? But the reality is I got multiple emails after that saying, how could you associate with the mob? How could you be? And I'm thinking, okay, we got to keep this in perspective. I wasn't sending any sort of message here. It was just a really cool opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's amazing people would even make that connection. And I remember when the show was even airing, you know, I'm Italian. You're Italian as well, Coach.
Yep.
Yeah. I remember the Italian Coalition for America. I don't know, Italian American, some organization was really upset with the show and trying to get the show shut down because of its portrayal of Italian Americans. It's art. I don't know. I don't know why people really get hung up on these things. I'm not sure.
Yeah, James Gandolfini was amazing. He was a big Jets fan. I don't know if you know that, but but he was great on set, and he was the one that said, "Look, you can't be friends with me. We got to change this. It's not going to look good." And I'm thinking, okay. Yeah, that was one thing I did. The other show that I actually was really excited to do was Sesame Street.
Oh, okay.
So when we had the good first season, you had an opportunity to potentially be on a late night show. And I said, you know, I'd really love to be on Sesame Street. My son loved Elmo and Mr. Noodle. Mm-hmm. And we ended up doing a segment with a bunch of players on Sesame Street. And that was pretty amazing too, just growing up with it. Ray, you're probably too young for Sesame Street, but you know, for me, it was a big part of our childhood.
Definitely.
Sure. No, that's excellent. I did coach, by the way, when I was little. I did watch Sesame Street.
Oh, you did? You caught a couple episodes? Uh-huh.
So probably some of the perks on being a coach in New York. Was there any bit of a difference when you were in Cleveland? I guess as far as like media attention and things of that nature.
Yeah, that was fun doing that. And if you win, there's a ton of perks.
Yeah.
But even the whole New York experience is you get to go do it at Sesame Street. But as I'm walking in to do Sesame Street, holding my son's hand, it was a Tuesday and we hadn't played very well against Buffalo in the second half the Sunday before. And this truck driver's driving by and he's like, "Hey man, Mangini, thanks for that pile of shit you put on the field on Sunday." And my son's like, Dad, why is that man yelling at you? And I'm like, I'm not sure. You don't worry about it. But it's that, you know, it comes with both sides.
Sure. Yeah, it comes with the territory. Yeah. And then that's what I guess while we're on the topic, I was going to ask you this. I was going to ask you who's more brutal fan wise, Jets or Browns.
That's a great question. Now in New York, there's so many teams that people and so many things to do and things that draw people's attention that sometimes even when you're not playing as well, you may not get as intense focus. Now there is also a significantly more people, but in Cleveland, the Browns are religion. And that's outside of Ohio State. It's the Browns. So they can be pretty intense. And there's frustration. There's years of frustration built up. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you necessarily walk in with a blank slate. There's a little more skepticism for anybody who comes in.
Yeah, sure. All right. And a reminder to the listeners, if you would like to join JJ, myself, and a supportive community of traders, you join us at microefutures.com. Coach, like we were talking about before we got on camera, a lot of similarities, comparisons that we can draw from football and trading. And I think it both really stems from being performance-based activities. I'm going to ask you about your experiences coaching and hopefully be able to tie it back into trading. But, you know, before we jump into that, during your college years, I know you went abroad to Australia. Your brother lives over there. He's an investment banker. This is what you were first looking into to get into a career, correct?
Yeah, I never, ever in a million years thought I'd coach football. It was not on my radar screen. I thought coaches were just gym teachers with whistles on it. And I go to Australia, and this is my junior year. My brother's there. He convinced me to do a semester abroad. I'm going to the University of Melbourne. And when I get there, internet's not a real thing. Cable's not very big. My brother's working all the time. I've got this downtime before I start college. I don't know anybody there. So this woman he works with is at a sporting goods store, and this guy, Stan Long, is trying to get to know her and is bragging about how he's coaching American football there. So she goes back, tells my brother, he tells me, I go see Stan and ask him if I can volunteer, thinking, okay, this would be a cool way to get to know people. And so he's coaching a team called the Doncaster Devils. I asked him if I can go out with him. He says, sure. We go out, and it takes about 10 minutes to realize that Stan Long looked like a football player, but had no idea about coaching. And again, this was before the internet was a big deal. So you couldn't research guys. You were kind of taking them at their word. So about 2 weeks into it, the Devils had been a good team. They got sick of Stan. They fired him. And they asked if I would help out. And I said, you know, I'm not really in a position to do that, but I like everybody here. I'll try to help as much as I can. And so Ray, they had this thing called faxes. I don't know if you're familiar with that either. Yeah. So my college coach used to fax me information in the morning. I'd look at the faxes, then I'd study it. I'd implement stuff. 2 weeks go by, too much damage done. The Devils fold. So I think, okay, I'm done with football in Australia. And I go back to start Melbourne University. A group of guys I became friends with went to a different team. They said, come just take a look. And so I had such a good time doing that, that I said, okay, I'll look at it. End up becoming the de facto head coach, defensive coordinator. Get to the summertime, I got to go back and make some money because I was on financial aid and I needed it for school. They said, well, what would it take for you to stay? And I told them. They took care of that, and we ended up winning the championship. It was this amazing experience. And I thought, okay, you know, it started to creep in that maybe this is something I want to do. And they said, we come back next year and do it next season. The seasons are opposite of what we have here. So their football season is in the spring. So I went back and coached the second year, brought a buddy of mine to be the offensive coordinator. We win the championship again. And at that point I thought, okay, this is something I want to explore. And the only job that I could get after I finished college, you know, that following fall, was as a ball boy for the Cleveland Browns. My college coach had become an offensive assistant for the Browns, and he said that's the way that I could get into the door. And so, you know, that's where it all started. It started as a ball boy and kind of moved up from there.
Yeah, and incredible how things work. Did you pick up any anything from your brother, anything in college while you were studying for this, any tips you took away from investing?
Well, the one thing that I saw is how hard he worked mm-hmm. and how hard now as a young guy in the investment banking, I mean, he set an example that was hard to follow. He was there, and I'm sure JJ that this is pretty mm-hmm. consistent with the world. He was there all the time. He was working weekends. It was 7 days a week. And you know, Parcells, when he had his first meeting at the Jets, the first time I was ever in a meeting with him, he said, you know, I'm going to give you three very simple tools to be successful. And he said, it's be on time, shows you're responsible, shows you're mature, shows you care. You care. He said, pay attention. You know, everybody here is trying to help you. And sometimes you got to listen very carefully because opportunity knocks softly. And then he said, work hard. He said, the NFL will make you rich. It can make you famous. It can do all these things, but you can't buy a championship. And to me, the work hard is the consistent thing, regardless of what you're doing, because as much as we want to shortcut things and find hacks and find simpler ways to do it, I mean, if you don't have that work ethic, you got no chance. Investing, football, doesn't matter.
Yeah. And I would assume JJ and Coach, I'd imagine you guys probably worked very similar hours, or at least quantity of hours at the height of your guys' careers, I'd imagine. JJ.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, 18 years of my life, pretty much, you know, 20 hour days, especially, yeah, deals don't wait for anyone. It's just, trading too, you know, when you're trading and you're trading a couple of different markets, you know, your clients want you to be, you got to be available 24/7. If you're not, there's a lineup of other people. You know, I always say I was always a speed dial away from being replaced, you know. So.
My sister used to say to me sometimes, my oldest sister, you know, you're so lucky you got that opportunity with Cleveland. You're so lucky. And it used to frustrate me because I think of the weekends I missed, the times with friends I missed, the family events I missed, the late nights and all those things. And the reality is the harder you work, the luckier you get. And it's not just going to fall into your lap.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I look at trading the same way too, JJ. It's like, you know, because a lot of what we do, Coach, you know, I could make a bad trade and win, and I could make a good trade and actually lose. And so like the luck factor is always there, but it's like, that's not what we focus on. We focus on the process. We focus on, reviewing just, you know, it's similar to football, right? Like, you know, there's some lucky bounces in football as well, but if your team prepared well, you feel like you came in a good game plan. I think that's all you control, and there's outside variables. You don't control what the refs do, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, yeah, and I'd say, Ray, there's always people that get lucky to win a game, and there's some teams that luck strikes and you win a Super Bowl. But if you're going to have sustainable success, you better have a process that works. You better have an ability to refine that process. You better have a clear vision of what you believe in, be able to articulate that. And otherwise, can you get a one-off? Can you hit a big trade one time? Yeah, probably. And look, it's happening a lot, right? Aren't there a lot of traders now that are kind of rushing into the market and maybe hitting big because momentum is going that way? But, you know, at the end of the day, they're probably going to be losing a lot more money than they make.
Yeah, right. It's like, are they still going to be able to trade in 5 years? You know, mm-hmm. it's that type of thing. It's a long run game. You know, anything can happen in the short term. I think, Coach, like, I think probably the most obvious thing that stands out to me of relating football and trading is the discipline. Because, you know, you could have all the talent in the world, but if you don't have the discipline, you're not going to win. What ways did you go about instilling discipline with your teams? Or, you know, I think, too, like, it almost seems, you know, these players have been playing football their whole lives. You think by the time they would get to you, they would have discipline. What was kind of your experience with that, and how would you go about it with the teams?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in discipline. I'm a big believer in the adage that discipline isn't something that you do to someone. it's something that you do for someone, and mm-hmm. and trying to articulate that, especially when I got to the Jets and how important that was difficult, because look, everybody wants to win and everybody wants to be successful, but to do the things that you have to do to get to that point, that's a grind. That's consistent. That's when things are going well, when things are going poorly, when you're tired, when you're, you know, right on down the line. First year at the Jets, I think we broke a team record for fines. And the next year we were in the bottom five. And once everybody understood how things were going to operate and then why they needed to operate at that level, it was a lot easier, but it's not an easy thing to install initially.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. Cause like, I think of a player on the Jets right now who I thought had, came out of college. I think he went to Miami, Chris Herndon, a tight end, and this guy has all the athletic talent in the world. And he's buried on the depth chart now. Like he's always been like a sleeper, people talking about, oh, watch out for him. And he has all the talent in the world. I just imagine he's not like just for whatever reason. I don't know if these guys just rely on their talent coming up to them, the pros, and then it just doesn't, they don't have that love of the game or the discipline. I guess, is that something that would happen frequently, Coach?
Yeah, unfortunately, you have debates all the time in the draft room about potential. This guy's got unbelievable potential. This guy, should be able to project it to do, you know, X, Y, and Z. But unless they're willing to take advantage of the opportunities that they have, unless that potential is married with some sort of character, then you've got no chance. And I'm a huge believer in character. And I think that, I say this all the time too, where ability sets the floor and character really sets the ceiling. When you've got guys with high character, then average becomes good, good becomes great, great becomes a Hall of Famer. And there's so many guys that, you know, they'll look back at their career and think, you know, why didn't it work out? And maybe they'll blame it on a coach, or maybe they'll blame it on, you know, I didn't get the best chance. Those are excuses for the most part. And you know, if you don't take advantage of the opportunities and the things that you've been given, somebody else is more than willing to rush in. And JJ said it, you know, it never stops, and there's always someone there that's willing to take the opportunity that you're not taking advantage of.
Yeah. Speaking of the drafting, I think you and Tannenbaum, I know a lot of people, not just myself, give you credit for that run the Jets had the next 2 years after you left in those AFC championships, drafted some really good players. Because you and Tannenbaum worked in tandem, right? It wasn't just one person had a say, correct?
No, one of the things that I really loved about working with Mike is that we could disagree without being disagreeable. We could go into a room, fight, discuss all those different things, but at the end of the day, we were going to come out and be on the same page. And if a player ever came in to Mike's office and said, hey, I'm unhappy with Eric, he'd call me up and I'd go in and we'd talk it out together with the player. And the same thing, I'm unhappy with Mike, I would do the same thing for him. So I always appreciated that ability to work through things. And I think it's more rare than the norm, at least in the NFL, to be able to disagree and still find a space that you can land on.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. No, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about some of that later on. So Coach, you were in charge of holding the team accountable. How did you hold yourself accountable?
Well, it's interesting, cause I was lucky in the sense of the football fathers that I had, mm-hmm. and being able to see Bill Parcells and how he operated, and then seeing Bill Belichick and how he operated. And the thing about Bill Belichick or a guy like Tom Brady is they live what Parcells was talking about: the success, the fame, the money. Those things didn't change them. They worked the same way every day. And so as a young person, being able to see what that work ethic looked like and to see the focus that they both had, It was a great example so that when I went to be a head coach, I knew what I was competing against. I wasn't just competing against that every now and then. It was twice a year I had to compete against that. And he had years and years of a head start in terms of his football knowledge and experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know what you're going up against. So it's gotta be full effort. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And just talking about getting lucky, you know, when you lost to New England or teams like New England, you could stomach it a little bit more because you knew what they put into that game. You knew that the players were smart. You knew that there was discipline and you knew that you got beat. And then you lose to some other teams and you know what that organization's like and what that team's like. And you're thinking, this is terrible. Losing is terrible, period.
Sure.
But losing to someone that you know didn't work as hard as you.
Yeah.
Awful.
I can relate, like, to, you know, that could happen, like, in poker, like when I was playing poker really serious. It's like, because there's just such a huge element of luck as well in that, in poker. And like, just knowing I'm better than this guy. Yeah, it hurts. It hurts way more when you know you're better. Yeah, it's always tough. You know, Coach, obviously all the teams, you guys would watch endless amount of game film. You know, me and JJ always use that analogy, right, Jay? We all the time watching game film to equating it to reviewing our trades.
Yep.
You know, the same thing. We go back, we study ourselves, what we could do better, what we're going to do going forward. But, you know, if you're a good trader, I'm assuming that's what everyone does. If you're, you know, all the NFL teams watch a lot of game film. Where do you think your edge came from when it came to game planning and a strategy perspective?
Well, first, in terms of reviewing the game film, one of the things that we would do after every game and then carried it over in New York and in Cleveland after events. So after the draft, free agency, OTAs, training camp, everything, we'd fill out an after action report. And the after action report is something that's big in the military. And the deal is for the enlisted men, they've got to give honest feedback and it can't be malicious. And for the officers, they've got to be open to that feedback and then they can't be punitive. And the idea is if you honestly assess an event and you need to be honest about it, you need to be completely honest with what went right, what went wrong, what the preparation errors were. The next time you face that event or next time you're coming up on that event, you've got such a great opportunity to take advantage of the experience that you had. And to me, that's a huge part of the process. And even with game planning, especially in the division, you play them the first time and you do that while it's fresh in your mind, it gives you a real head start the next time you do it. And on a personal level, I was in the back of the room one time with this guy named Roman Pfeiffer, great linebacker, great person. I think it was his 10th or 11th year at the time. He'd been with a few different teams and he was writing in his notebook. And I said, what are you doing? Cause I could tell it wasn't just football plays that he was going through or the game plan. He said, I'm writing about my week. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the things I had for lunch or what time I got up or when I worked out or how I worked out or how I practiced. And he said, this is just current me talking to future me. And when you think about it, can you really remember what you did last week or last month? Mm-hmm. And so he would then go through in the next week, he'd look at the process that he had in place and the things that didn't produce success, he would try to remove. And then he'd see whether or not by removing that, it would change, or he tried to do something the same. And that's how he stayed in the league as long as he did. And that's how he was constantly refining his own personal process.
Yeah, which is incredible too, because JJ, right? Like,
that's a beautiful traders, display of the discipline.
Yeah, well, traders highly recommend, like I journal. I know a lot of people I trade with journal, and for the same reasons. To go back, review yourself. How was I feeling during the day when I traded? Looking for different cues and refining your process, like you mentioned.
And I would think too, the emotional element of that too. Were you frustrated? Were you anxious? Were you desperate to make a trade? Were you patient? Were you, you know, there's sometimes where you may be gun shy because you just got beat up on the last trade.
Exactly.
And yeah. How do you take that emotion out of it?
Yeah.
And get to the space where I'm making this objectively and unemotionally because it's the best decision right now.
Yep, nailed it. You nailed it, coach. Yeah,
nailed it. And that's why we, I always compare, because we have these, you know, these charts, and you can replay them, and you can actually watch the price action replay through the day. And I always say it's like watching game film. Like, how did you know Mike Singletary every time, you know, someone was at that gap, he was there. Like, you know, like how the hell did he know that because he had just prepared and that discipline, that really, it brings a lot of difference. It's quite amazing.
It's interesting when I worked for Bill, obviously, in Cleveland initially, and then went to Baltimore when the Browns became the Ravens with Ted Marchibroda. And he had a really interesting approach, because I was, you know, going through volumes of things, and he would actually just watch the human beings. And he wanted me to study very specific guys and just see what their tell was. So usually we'd start with the youngest guy. You start with the youngest player on defense. That was the offensive assistant at the time. And because they're the most nervous, they're the most apt to give away the defense early, because they don't want to be wrong. They don't want to make a mistake. So you're studying those guys first. And then we'd put together this list of not just what they do, but what they wouldn't do. So we'd eliminate a bunch of stuff based off of these keys that we got, which then simplified things for quarterbacks. And then we try to tie in and see who had the tell, and you know, just tying it back to poker some more. Whenever you played Brady or Manning or any of the great quarterbacks, you know, our thing was, if you're not lying, you're not trying. And you better give them stuff that they don't expect. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they've looked at the charts, mm-hmm. they've reviewed the film, they've they'll eat you up.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I think. Like, equating it to poker, like, because when you get to such a high level, and he knows what I know, and he know, like, the meta game has to be crazy going on, and like, yeah, like the chart, like, just staying sharp, staying disciplined. Yeah, no, I'm sure. Just you could get lost in the mind games, I'm sure.
I'd be interested. So we're constantly talking to players about moving on to the next play.
Yeah.
And that's a really hard thing to do.
Sure.
And I think it was Dan O'Brien, the decathlete, we had come speak, and he said there was a 5-second rule. So you had 5 seconds to either be happy or sad, and then life moves on, and you got to go on to the next thing. And that's how he went from the failure that he had, I think it was the 80 Olympics, to having success in the next Olympics, getting that mindset. But when you mess up a trade, or you make a mistake that is devastating, how do you get back to the mindset of that you need to be in to make the next trade as objectively?
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll answer first, and I'll let you go, Jay. I think if it's devastating, coach, like a real tough loss, I might just get away from the computer. I might just go for a walk and just like reset myself, especially if I recognize I'm emotional. Like if I'm angry, if I'm tense, like I know when I'm not in a good mindset, like I can recognize it. Cause I know there was a time where I could fool myself that like, oh no, like I've been trading for so long. Like I can do this, but no, like I really can't, like, cause it's hard. Yeah, that part of your brain shuts down. Like if you're really emotional, I forget what the part of the brain is, but you like literally can't think logically. Or to your capacity of logic. So for me, it's always been like, I'll step back, coach, but it has to be devastating. I can take losses pretty well now and just move on. At my point, like if it's a, you know, standard loss, but if it's something that really wipes out a lot of money, yeah, that's tough. But that's why we have risk parameters, and we hope we don't ever get in that type of situation. But yeah, what do you think, Jay?
Yeah, I agree. I'm, because I've been in the market since 1993. I'm cheap. So with me, when it comes to losses, one thing I had to do was develop discipline, because I was an institutional guy, and we really didn't have that much discipline. Retail is completely different because you're not allowed to cheat. You don't have any of the, you don't have any of the tools that you have and the leverage and the capital. So you've got to be much smarter, get in and out. And for me, if I take two or three trades, what I do is I size small, and then if I'm good, then, you know, I'll keep going. if on very small amounts of money, if I'm not seeing the market well, I stop trading. And then I'll go back to the drawing board, and it's either something that I'm not seeing, or it's some sort of a bias or something like that. And because capital preservation is our biggest thing, right? Because you got to be able to have money to trade the next day when you actually can see it.
You know? Let me ask you this. How do you, because the thing that happens in sports too, is you got to teach guys how to deal with adversity.
Yeah.
But you also have to teach people how to deal with success. And Teddy Atlas, the famous boxing trainer, said success is like a martini. It relaxes you. If you're hitting it, if things are going well, how do you know? Do you double down? Do you go with the hot hand? Or how do you know, okay, this wave probably isn't going to last forever. I need to tempo it down.
For me, I trade for income. And I actually trade retail for relaxation, because I used to make markets and take companies public and then make a market to sell that stock into. So you're dealing with, you know, lots of people who have, you know, pretty harsh agendas, and it's very stressful. So this I find kind of relaxing. So what I do is I'll have, like, you know, I'll do a couple of trades, I'll make a decent amount of money, and I'll stop. And because I grew up in the business ever since I was young, I look at it as more of a business, it is gambling because we are speculating, but I always look at it from the business point of view. It's okay. I traded this. This was an inventory correction. Now, what are they doing on the other side? Now it's going to be choppy. So I'm just going to sit back. Right. It's knowing the market that you're in.
And the question I was asking Ray earlier, JJ, before you got on, is what's a win? Well, what's considered, if you were trading daily, is it, so for a big play run could be 4 yards, you know, that could be a successful run.
Yeah.
And then say, you know, pass, people have different parameters, but at what point is it a win and you take your win and you go home?
For me, I'm a big advocate of trading for income, especially in the markets that we're in. So for me, if I'll have sort of like a daily sort of target in the back of my head. It's not a hard target. It's not like I have to get there. But what I do is I take usually 2 or 3 trades a day, no more than that. And so my goal is to make $300 to $500 a day, right? There's 20 trading days in a month, and that just pays all your bills. Right.
Yeah.
When markets are better and there's more institutional participation and better order flow, then I'll adjust those models. And, you know, and then like last March in 2020, you know, I was having really good days, but the volatility was there, the order flow was there, and you were able to execute. So I'm a big advocate of knowing what kind of market you're trading in. It's just like business. You know, if you're selling sunglasses, you don't want to be going to a place where it's rainy to try and sell sunglasses, right? And people just don't realize that it is a market. I mean, we really over-fancify it. But, you know, this thing started 300 years ago under a tree. And, you know, trading is all about supply and the amount of order flow that's coming in. So if it's a heavy volume market and it's liquid and there's a lot of participants in it, my profit expectations will be a little higher. Right now, it's a very hit and run market. Get in, get out, get paid, because the moves don't last very long.
How do you account for the Reddit world? So I have a 17-year-old son, and he has a little investment account. He came down, he's like, "Oh, I want to buy AMC."
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, Jake, what do you even know about? I think, you know, movies are coming back. Okay, so I'm like, you're probably gonna lose this money that I put in for you, and he's like, okay, that's fine. I think, and so he went up like 300%, and now he thinks, you know, that he's ready for Wall Street, but it's, you know, now it's, I think he's back down to 150% gain, but how do you account for that world where it's not about fundamentals, it's not about anything besides emotion.
For me, I find it fascinating because I see the shift in the mentality. My job was to figure out what people want and give it to them in the old days, right? So I would, you know, I'd look at a deal and say, okay, we got to market it this way, do the advertising this way, and promote it this way to get people to buy the stock. So I look at this Reddit world now. I think it's fascinating that these young kids are getting involved in investing at such a young age. You know, like I didn't really discover the markets until I was about 22 when I decided to get into it. But, you know, when I was 15, I was, you know, just having a good time, not even a care in the world. Last thing I was looking at was buying IBM.
JJ, they're investing in bankrupt companies, though, JJ.
They are. But it's a good, but it's some of them will learn through this process.
Sure.
Right. They're going to lose money. Some will make money. Some will lose money. But at least they're getting used to the idea that, hey, you know what? There is a mechanism that if I figure out what I'm doing, right?
Yeah, you know,
maybe that light bulb moment will come in, and you know they'll learn about how to manage their finances at a younger age. Because I mean, when I was a teenager, I didn't. I was just, you know, I was living minute to minute. You know, so it's interesting to see. I think it's fast. I think it's great. You know,
but don't you think it's a little bit, Ray? And I don't. I'm speculating here on your world, but every gambler that I've ever talked to, I only hear about his good days. Like I very rarely hear about the days where they lost a ton of money. And I wonder if, I think sometimes with the Reddit world, people are only putting out when they win.
Exactly.
And so a lot of these kids aren't, you know, they.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's almost a distorted reality.
That's true.
Well, cause there's a, like you said, people are more apt to show their gains than their losses. I think too, it's better marketed that way. Oh, hey, like it's all because a lot of these people sell services. A lot of these people, you know, it's a more markety. It sounds better. And as a gambler too, I don't like, this is just how I think. And the thing with trading too, Coach, is that there's so many different ways to skin a cat. And I don't know if there's a comparable to football, maybe like how you might have different offensive schemes. Like you might have maybe a run heavy team, then you have a more of a pat. Like there's different ways to win, right? Like there's not always just one blueprint to win. Same with trading. But for me, like I stay away from those because like I feel like most of the people invested in those things are not smart investors. And I don't want to be, you know, because with trading, I want to be, or gambling, I like to see what the sharp people are doing. The people who I respect, the smart people, and I try to align myself with them or at least give more weight to that. Hey, why is he looking at this? And invest this way. And I wanted to come back to something you were saying about dealing with wins, because that really resonated with me. And that's something that's always been really tough for me when I've been on hot streaks, Coach, is because I start getting a big ego. I think I'm God's greatest gift. And usually what happens afterwards is I go on a massive down streak, you know, because I get inflated and I think it's like, yeah, like you can't get too high or too low. And I'm sure you preach the same thing to the players. Because when you're going good, maybe it's even more troublesome than when you're bad. Because sometimes getting your ass kicked wakes you up a little bit.
Yeah, it's dealing with success is really a skill set. And we were the last team to repeat in New England in what is it, 20 plus years?
Oh, yeah.
Because what happens is you go into the next season, and everybody thinks they're the reason that you won. Everybody wants to get a raise. Everybody wants a new contract. Everybody's out doing commercials or doing other things, building their brand, that type of thing. And what you don't realize is that now all the things that you did well the year before, you have to do better because everybody is chasing you. Everybody is studying you, and everybody is playing up to you. And that's a real tough lesson to learn and a tough thing to go through. And when we won the first Super Bowl in New England, we ended up missing the playoffs the following year. We started great. Then we went through a rough patch and we finished 9-7. The Jets finished 9-7. The Dolphins finished 9-7 and we got knocked out of the playoffs. And we learned from that experience of what, how we need to do adjust to success, because you know, we're able to do it well and won back-to-back Super Bowls the following 2 years. But it's difficult because when you're successful too, everybody thinks they're a little smarter than they are. You know, everybody thinks they might have the secret sauce or the formula. And the reality is you have to start over the next season. You don't get to start where you left off.
Yeah.
And it's it's a hard thing to teach.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Coach, you know, like football, man, like football is so, I think this is what makes it a great sport is the swings. Football, like an in-game football, can go from like looking great to now you're down to interception. Like the swings are nuts. How was it for you, like as the head coach, especially trying to stay even keel for the team and just to make good decisions?
It's funny, Ray, because I got criticized both in New York and Cleveland for not being more demonstrative on the sideline.
I know. I remember.
And here is what I learned both in with Bill Parcells and Bill Belichick is if you're caught up in a celebration of a touchdown or something that happened, or you're in the tank because something bad happened, you're not processing what actually happened. You're not sitting down with the players and going through, okay, this is what we need to fix, or this is what we need to attack, or this is the situation that's coming up. It took a lot of discipline to take the emotion out of it. But I felt like as a coaching staff and as a leader, it was my responsibility to be able to give the guys the best, most meaningful information in the moment, as opposed to, you know, getting kind of caught up and derailed. And you'll see coaches get derailed where then they miss something situationally that comes up, or, you know, a guy's celebrating a sack and during a 2-minute drive and the offense is getting set up and it's like, yeah, how does this happen? How could this possibly happen?
Yeah, for sure. Cause you'll see coaches and I mean, even as a fan, and I always try and like reserve judgment, right? Because it's like, listen, I'm not a coach. I'm not there every day with the players and stuff, but I know some fans just go bonkers, right? But it's pretty obvious. There's some coaches that are just so bad at in-game management or just in-game decisions. And it's very baffling almost. I don't know if that's
it is baffling.
Yeah.
Ray, but I can tell you it's a lot easier now to make those decisions on my couch than
sure,
it is
right?
when
yeah.
you're in the moment. There's 70,000 people screaming. The situation is changing, you know, rapidly, and you're trying to sure. navigate through it. I think there's a space for building training protocols to go through those situations, it so that you can do it in the off season, almost like a training simulator.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody's, you know, we worked on something like that in New York and Cleveland. I don't think it's there yet though.
Okay,
but you've got to be able to process that stuff very quickly with
a lot going on. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I wasn't sure if that was something you guys did, like practice or go over, because it's similar. You know, listen, like I've never done it, right? But like trading, poker, certain things, like you have to make timely decisions. Like you don't have forever to make it. You have to make a quick decision, and I think there's ways to train on that.
Well, hooray! I hired the guy who was the head of officials for the NFL who had retired, mm-hmm. Head of replay. He had been the head of replay to be my replay guy in Cleveland. And there were times okay. where he got it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, this is the person who ran the program. Sure. And this is no knock on him. It's not an easy job. But when you're watching through a camera and slow motion and you've got multiple angles, it's easier than if you're watching from the booth and you sure. may or may not have a good feed. And it depends how many cameras are at the game. But seeing him struggle at times, I thought, okay, this isn't as easy as we sometimes make it out to be.
Sure. I think another huge part that correlates with trading is, you know, we could come in, you know, have a plan with a trade, then things go totally different than what we expected, right? Like, so you might come into a football game, you guys have a game plan. Maybe the defense is showing you a different looks than you expected, or the offense is coming up with different plays. How important was in-game adjustments for you or just in football in general?
It's really important. And it's, you know, there's different levels of that. There's the scheme perspective in terms of what you're doing. And then there's the things that happen when someone gets hurt. Mm-hmm. So you practice during the week, you've got one guy who gets the bulk of the reps, there's a backup, he's got to go in, he's got certain limitations. Now you've got to adjust what you can and can't run. So there's there's variables on top of the variables. And, you know, I always thought Mike Shanahan was one of the greatest coaches at forcing you into adjustments. And what Mike would do is it didn't matter what he had done the week before. It mattered what weaknesses you had shown on tape. And there's one year we went up and played him in Denver and we had two adjustments out of empty. And he played 65 snaps of empty because then he had certainty. He knew whether we were pressuring or whether we were in zone defense. And the week before, he'd played the whole game out of 22 against the Ravens. And that, I think I got the years right, 22 is two backs, two tight ends, like big people.
Yeah.
So it's you think you know what you're going to get from the offense, but when you coach defense, everything is a reaction to what they do.
Right. Exactly. Cause yeah, they're on the offense. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. They control the cadence. They control the personnel group. They control formations, everything.
Yeah. And Shanahan, it's hoping the Jets, cause the Jets now kind of coaching staff has some links to the Shanahans coming over from San Francisco. So I'm hoping it's looking good.
Yeah. I mean, Kyle's a little bit different than his dad. I mean, there's elements of that, but you know, a little bit different offensive philosophy. And I don't know if you're going to get apples to apples.
Well, okay. So yeah, no, I'm just curious from your perspective. Obviously, you know a lot more. So what's the difference between him and his father, you think, like scheme wise or philosophy wise?
Similar to how we were in New England, where everything is game plan specific.
Yeah.
So as much as you want to sit and watch New England and say, okay, in the last four games, they've done this. So by percentage, we can expect, you know, this number of blitzes or offensively, we can expect this amount of empty. That's not the case. We were going to do what we needed to do to beat you on that Sunday. And that's what made Mike so difficult. I think Kyle has more. He's still game plan specific and very bright and very good at what he does, but there's more of a core that carries over from week to week.
Got you. And I got to imagine, like, you know, it's probably why teams have had such a hard time against the Patriots. Like, I guess not having a quote unquote style or an approach and being like, you know, adapting to your opponent and coming with that. Is that something you took when you went to the Jets?
Yeah, absolutely. So everybody talks about being game plan specific, and they are, in the sense that they will take things out of their playbook that work best against that opponent. But truly being game plan specific, you need guys that are very bright, and you need guys that can adjust mentally during the course of the week. So we'll come through and it could be radically different than what it was the week before. And for some teams, if they're not used to that, or players that aren't used to that, it's really hard because it's a volume, but we drafted a certain type of player and then we trained a certain type of way. So that was our norm, which made it easier. And you hear people say, we're going to do what we do. Well, that's great until someone does what you do better than you do. And you've got no second pitch.
Yeah.
You know, and we, that's not how we were going to operate.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Getting players who understand what you're trying to do from like a scheme perspective or what you guys are trying to achieve makes total sense, right? You moving in unison. So, another similarity with football and trading, I think is huge is learning how to deal with losses. And I know we kind of touched about this like a little bit, like the emotional aspect, but how did you deal with losses? Especially like knowing that you put in like so much preparation during the week and like, I'm assuming you gave it your all just to come out with a loss.
It's one of the downsides is that the wins, like the feeling that you have that after the wins that lasts for like this amount of time. And unfortunately the feeling you have after the loss lasts a lot longer. Mm-hmm. And you hear about hangovers and we all know that, you know, that hangover can last a lot longer than maybe the night before did. And I think there's some similarities there, but you're constantly coaching and teaching and talking to the players about being able to move on. And usually because you've got such a big amount of work and information to process and put in place the next week, after about that Monday, Tuesday phase, and you start working on the next team, that the challenge of the next week helps overcome the loss. But what you want it to hurt. Like if you have players that it doesn't hurt, then that's a whole nother problem.
Yeah, sure. You know, Coach, I haven't worked for different organizations, different coaches over the years. How much of there is there a discrepancy of maybe football methodology and like how maybe like Belichick would go about something and then maybe like another coach you played for? Or is there more similarities than that?
Well, I'd say it's can be radically different. Mm-hmm. And I've talked about New England. With New England, there's no officers club. Okay, you don't that doesn't exist, and it's not for everyone. It's a demanding environment. It's consistently demanding, so it's not like you get this time to unwind. You're gonna be held accountable, and you're gonna be held accountable, oftentimes in a public way. And there are incredible expectations. And there's also, I think one of the things that makes Bill so good at what he does too, is there is a ruthlessness to personnel decisions that may not exist other places. And I don't say that in a negative way. You know, we want our coaches and our decision makers to make the best decision for the group. But sometimes that's an emotional decision that the fan base and even the team can have a really hard time with. You know, Bill cut Bernie Kosar in Cleveland, who was as beloved a quarterback as you could get, and several players in New England. I mean, he moved on from Tom Brady. So, but that ability to do that is a positive, but very hard to do. And other places there's places that are radically different. There's places that it's much lighter. It's much more relaxed. It's much, it's a much more understanding environment. And there's something to be said for that. And personalities fit in places, very differently as well. But I'd say that the sort of unique environment in New England has helped it have sustained success.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I was thinking about the Jets' last coach, man, and I know the fan base obviously didn't like him. I mean, I just think, just like his method, like, because there was a lot of times he would, and maybe this was the way the media would spin things, you know, I don't know, but he would say things like, hey, the players got to play. Like almost like saying, like blaming his like schemes on the players almost. And like, I get that, like the players do have to play, but you got to put your players in the best position possible. I mean, that's your job as a coach, right? Like to get the best out of your players. And I think that's something like Bill is least known for doing well. Like he's putting the players in good positions for them to succeed.
Yeah. And look, having success early in New England. So we went 5-11 the first season and we were 1-3, and Bill, when he was in Cleveland, had one winning season 5 years as a head coach. And people forget that. People forget, mm-hmm. You know, you think of where he is now. When we went to New England, they hated us. They didn't want us there. And the first year kind of played into that situation, but we're consistent with what we were able to do. And then we're able to win. And then that allowed the framework to be in place for the environment that's there now that continues to allow them to win. But trying to transition a new organization who you know isn't used to that type of discipline, there's a lot of pushback. And if you don't win early, there's less and less patience for establishing an organization. And I talk about it with owners, you know, they want you to cook a turkey, but they want it cooked in a microwave. And it's just not realistic if you're looking for long-term sustainable success.
Is there a lot of discrepancy too, like between maybe like ownership and what they want at times and like hampering on coaches and really, you know, cramping, I guess, like how you want to run the organization?
Well, here's a piece of advice I got very early on. This said, you know, when you go home at night, you, you need to be happy with your assistant coaches. And if they don't like it, tell them to go get their own head coaching job. And he said, but when the owner goes home at night, he needs to be happy with you. And if you don't like it, go buy your own team. Mm-hmm. So that's the reality. That's the world we all live in. We all have a boss. And, you know, I loved talking to the owners because I thought, okay, if you've achieved this level of success in your industry, you're obviously extremely bright. You've dealt with tremendous amounts of difficult situations. You've had to navigate through all kinds of changes. What can I learn from you? Now, there are times where, you know, the football world, the sports world, it doesn't match up with the business world in the way that it operates.
Yeah.
And owners, sometimes from a football perspective, it's like doing business in China. You're mm-hmm. at the mercy of the translator.
Exactly.
So whoever they're getting information from can affect maybe how they relate to you. There's definitely challenges from a ownership perspective, but it's also their right.
Yeah, it's
that's true.
Right. Yeah,
that's a really cool statement because I always look at, you know, like someone like Arthur Blank, who owns the Atlanta team, you know, he created Home Depot, right, with Ken Langone. I mean, these guys, they are probably responsible for creating the marketing for the whole home improvement market, which, you know, the size of that market, you know, and positioned Home Depot to be right at the epicenter of it and benefit from it. That's very cool. So, you know, you can, that's really great because, you know, it'd be just to spend an hour with someone like that. Well, you know, for someone like me, is, you know,
JJ, you know what, you know, it's so interesting. Much. The Carolina's owner, something Tepper, Jake Tepper, Jack Tepper. He was a hedge fund. He
ran, that's right. Fund, yeah. Right? Yeah.
On Carolina. So I'm really interested to see how he takes that trader mindset into being an owner.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be interesting. I'm definitely interested to see how Carolina performs as an organization.
Steve Cole, you know, the Mets.
When I talk to owners too, and I'm not vested in their decision, I tell them that the most important thing that they can have is someone who will tell them the truth, because everybody in their world has an agenda. Sure. Everybody has something that they want from them. And the only way that they can actually leverage their experience, their knowledge, their wealth of decision-making is if they're getting good information, if they're getting the truth. And I also say, like, you got to be okay with getting the truth. You may not like what you're going to hear sometimes, but you need someone that's going to give you that information so that you can actually be effective as an owner and use what you have to help your organization be successful.
Yeah. Yeah. So coach, I was actually, last week I watched it for the first time. I don't know if you've seen it. It was a documentary on HBO. It had Nick Saban and Bill Belichick, them, you know, sitting talking, you know, about coaching, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the topics they brought up was coaching in like this social media age, and maybe the challenges. I don't know if you've talked with people about this, maybe some of the different challenges that you might have to deal with, maybe the players, then, you know, even during your time.
Yeah, I think it's hard because in a team environment, you're always trying to teach we before me. And you know, the idea of team success helps individual success. But there's such a premium now on building your brand, promoting your identity, yeah. promoting the things that you're doing, which there's nothing wrong with that. But it can really make it difficult to crack through and let people see the bigger picture. I think people in general have a difficult time seeing the world through any lens besides their own. And then when the focus is so much on you, it's hard to get them to we and to see the value of we. And there's so much information out there, and the information comes very quickly. and situations can escalate dramatically within minutes, where years ago things were fairly contained and there was maybe some more time to process events before it's out in the world and everybody's commenting on it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got to be unique and different experience. Just, you know, and I guess it goes back to just adapting, right? It's like, hey, the world's always going to change. Football's going to change, adapting to it. So coach, like trading, I believe football mirrors life, you know, in certain respects. I've learned a lot about myself through trading, a ton when playing football. What have you learned about yourself through football being a head coach?
Well, you know, my kids have played football. My oldest isn't playing now, but he played for a few years. My middle one is, my youngest one is. And I had such a great experience being part of a team. I had, you know, whether it was my high school coach and I went to an inner city school and had all the inner city challenges that you have. And my coach, Graham Martin, was one of those people. He's firm, he was fair, he was consistent, and he would hold everybody the same standard. He would give everybody the same opportunity. He would set a really high bar, and more often than not, people would raise up to that bar that he set, and he'd affect thousands and thousands of life. And that impacted me. And going through the process of winning a Super Bowl, I remember in New Orleans walking across the Superdome, and there's confetti on the floors with my wife, and there's no more games to play. There's no more practices to get ready for. There's no more tape to break down. And we were the best in the world at what we did. And I was part of something that was bigger than myself. And that was a really rewarding moment, not just in sports, but in life. And I think that's the value that sports can give you. And I think sports is another really unique opportunity to break down barriers, stereotypes, prejudices, because most locker rooms are a cross-section of society. There's white, black, there's old, young, East Coast, West Coast, all different religions. And then you come together through a sport as a team, and you realize that that person is not that different than I am. And my preconceived notions were wrong. And I love that aspect of sports, bring people together that maybe never would have been together, and breaking down some stereotypes that shouldn't be there in the first time or first place. So those are some of my things that I love.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree anymore. Yeah, the camaraderie, bringing people from all different backgrounds together to achieve an objective together, something bigger than yourselves. Yeah, beautiful, well said. I mean, my son's 7 years old. He's playing. He's just starting this year. And like, yeah, that's what I was telling him. And he's loving the camaraderie with the teammates. You know what I mean? Like the joking around, but like them going to achieve it together. Coach, I think you mentioned your boys, or at least a couple of them, play football. Well, I couldn't imagine what it's like to be the coach of their teams, like knowing that you're one of the one of the parents. So he must be like shitting himself. I don't know, like to make a decision. What's that like for you?
I haven't asked for a lot of feedback from me, so I guess that they've got it all figured out. So I'm very happy to be a dad and watch them, you know, do what they do, and then help them whenever they need help. It's funny though. I remember, you know, my middle son was out working on throwing. This is when he was younger, mm-hmm. And I came out and I said, oh, you know, why don't you try this with your hands, and your feet should go here, and then here's the follow through. He's like, yeah, you know, Dad, my gym teacher told me to do it this other way. And I'm like, look, there's not a lot of things in life I may be able to help you with, but this is one of them.
Exactly.
This is an area I promise you I can help you in. Yeah. And I'm sure JJ, you've gone through this with your kids where they'll listen to everybody else sometimes before they listen to you, and then they'll circle back to you.
I'm not responsible enough to have had children, but I do understand, because when I'm teaching people how to trade, they'll be like, no, I'm like, no, really, because you know, this is going to happen. They're like, no. I'm like, well, I used to do this. So, you know, right at this time of the day, this is when I knocked the market down and oh, there it is, you know? So it's, it's an interesting observation.
Yeah, I got to get out of that. You know, sometimes I'll be like, yeah, you know, Jake, I won 3 Super Bowls, but I don't know.
But you're right. Yeah.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
I mean, you're 15 years old, but you're probably right.
Yeah.
What do I know?
It's just a funny dynamic sometimes between, you know, parent and child, you know, who knows, man. Coach, the best Jet, I think, during my lifetime, and I love Curtis Martin. He was my favorite player growing up. I love Curtis, but I think it's probably Darrell Revis, at least at his peak. I believe you and Tannenbaum drafted him, correct? Mm-hmm. You guys drafted Revis. He's a Hall of Famer in my opinion. He should be a Hall of Fame pick. Great job by you guys. What did you guys see when you drafted Revis?
That was interesting. That was one of those situations where we had set up the trade the night before with Carolina. Mm-hmm. We said, okay, if our guy is there, you know, we want to move up to your spot. I think it was 13 or 14 and everything was in place, but it was all contingent on us having our player on the board, which was Darrell. And Darrell, there are certain things that I looked for. I wanted someone about 5'11 and a half, about 195, you know, from a height, weight, and a certain speed, mm-hmm. just because that was, in my experience, the ideal, you know, combination. And then it was the intangibles of, there's a whole list that we had, and he had checked all of those boxes. And then it's, can you play man to man? Can you play in the deep part of the field? Can you tackle? Those are the big three of DBs. And as we went through the stages, it was check, 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 you know, each box was checked off. And there wasn't a box that we looked at where we thought, okay, this is going to be a liability or a weakness. It was all strengths.
Yeah. I mean, obviously incredible pick. I mean, I guess from you, because I know you've coached some good defenses. I'm pretty sure. I think Ty Law was on those Super Bowl teams.
I had Ty Law, I had Lawyer Malloy, Rodney Harrison, Asante Samuel. Revis, I'm sure I'm forgetting some different guys, but we had a really talented group over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I think Revis, and I could be biased, you know, I'm not asking you to pick here, but I think Revis at his prime was probably, I mean, some of those years he was locking down the best in the game, Calvin Johnson, Julio Jones. I remember some of these games very vividly and he was one-on-one with these guys. I mean, that's rare to find. I mean, you're the best receivers in the NFL. I don't know, what do you think? Like, as far as like, top corners you've coached?
Well, look, what I'd say about Ty Law is Ty, and they're both from the same area in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I think it's the same town actually, but Ty had
Mike Dicka's from there too.
Oh, really?
That they're all from
like Alapika or Alapa, something like that. West Pennsylvania.
Aliquippa.
Yeah, Aliquippa. Yeah.
Cool.
And what I'll say about Ty is Ty had unbelievable ball skills.
Yeah, he
did. So he was able to, his instincts, his ability to catch the ball, those were unique. And Ty had a very, very short memory. And there was an unpredictableness to the way that he played that made it, you know, sometimes really hard on me and also hard on opposing quarterbacks. But the ball skills, I'd say if Darrell had one thing that was maybe a little bit less than Ty, it would be that. But you know, we're shaving
the
very small edges.
No, exactly. Asante
Samuel too was a guy who had unbelievable instincts and great ball skills.
Amazing.
And he was a guy we picked up in the fourth round that just unique that way.
Yeah. I mean, I give cornerbacks the utmost respect, especially like the top notch ones. It's gotta be probably one of the hardest, if not the hardest position to play on the football field. I mean, I at least think so, you know.
Well, you talk about that short memory.
Yeah.
You better have a short memory if you play cornerback, because in the NFL, once they see a weakness, it's like sharks to blood. You're going to get it over and over and over again. So if you go in the tank after giving up a big play, you are guaranteed to get multiple big plays because they're going to attack you.
Yeah.
There's no forgiveness.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, maybe someone like, JJ, he, I don't know if you know, but, I don't know if it was your last year there, coach, but, Brett Favre, coach, had Brett Favre to New York for a year. That strikes me something Brett Favre was good at. He could have like the worst games. Maybe not with the Jets, but like throughout his career, he would have just terrible games throwing three, four picks. And he comes back and leads them, lead Green Bay to, you know, a win or something. And that he always strike me as somebody who could just shrug it off and go back out and still gunsling.
Yeah. Brett was, incredible like that. He could throw two picks and line up and do it again. And, and that's a gift. That's a gift too. I admire people who are able to shake things off so quickly and chalk it up to what it is. Hey, I made a mistake and I'm going to go out and take my shot the next time, because, you know, we missed opportunities by not shooting too.
Definitely. You absolutely do. And I think the opportunity cost could be huge that way. And I know they've done analytic studies and stuff of this, but like being aggressive and like hitting a good play like that is worth more than a lot of times than the downside of maybe throwing a pick. It's situational and game dependent, but you know, I find these things interesting because I think, yeah, the opportunity cost of being scared can cost you a win, and you see it a lot too. And that's one thing that I get frustrated with is coaches that play, they don't play to win. They play not to lose. And I mean, I could say maybe if you have a roster that way. Yeah. What do you think, coach?
Well, I hear you, but I think what happens, what you'll find in the NFL is more games are lost than they're won.
Okay.
And that's one of the first things you have to do as a team is you have to not lose the game. You can't have the self-inflicted wounds. And
sure.
And I was just talking about that study that you mentioned where big plays versus interceptions. And the correlation between turnovers differential and win percentage is pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to think that the big plays would offset that, but I know there's a lot of research going into it. But before you even get to the point where you can win the game, you just got to make sure that you're not doing things to lose the game. Penalties, turnovers, substitution errors, things like that. Those self-inflicted wounds will kill you. And going back to Brett Favre, I remember having a conversation with him just being like, look, everything doesn't have to be a home run. You know, you can, some doubles are pretty good and a single's not bad either.
Yeah.
You know, I love that we're hitting home runs, but you know, if we can limit at least bring the strikeouts down a little bit, that'd be great too.
That's funny. I guess a last question, coach, I'll let you get going. Any thoughts? How do you think the Jets, I'm excited, but it's always a thing with the Jet fans. It's like, you know how it's been, it's been rough the last few years. I'm excited. I like some of the players. The quarterback's looking good so far. Do you have any thoughts on the Jets this year?
Yeah. What's that disclaimer like at the bottom of every trading thing that
this is not financial advice?
Current results are not the
past results are not indicative of future performance.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing is as fans, sometimes there's this feeling like we're cursed or it's never going to happen. That's not how it works. Each year is its own individual entity, its own moment in time. And, you know, the Jets have an uphill battle because you do have a new head coach. You've got a rookie quarterback. That rookie quarterback has the pressure of where he was drafted. He has the pressure of New York.
Yeah.
He doesn't really have an established veteran who's nurturing him in that locker room, that sometimes they traditionally have.
Yeah.
And then you've got three teams in the division that have complicated defensive schemes, have aggressive defensive schemes. And, you know, the last guy started seeing ghosts and hopefully as a young player, you're not going to get to that point where you get a little shell shocked early. But I'd say go in, be optimistic, make sure you give them, you know, every benefit of the doubt and see where it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it can't get worse than it was last year.
It can always get worse.
Ooh, ouch.
I hope not, coach.
I'm not commenting on the current
Sure.
But I've heard people say, well, it can't get any worse. It's like,
I can.
Yeah, I can.
Well, hey, that's why, man, football, man, it's just a great sport, though. Even if the Jets are not good, I just enjoy watching all the teams. Football seems like it's really progressing. Well, or progressing or changing. And it's kind of exciting. And coach, it does seem like, I said that was going to be the last question, but I think I've been noticing and we're seeing is a lot of these young players are coming out of college and performing well right away. I mean, I think specifically some of the quarterbacks and the receivers, I think a lot of these rookie receivers have been coming out well. Do you think there's any correlation there, or it's just maybe just been the recent years?
It's a little different for each guy. That transition from college football to pro football is difficult. You figure you go from being the big man on campus, you know, the coaching staff, you know, the scheme, you know, the area that you lived in, all those things. And we've all started new jobs. You got to go through the process of who's coaching me, where do I go? I got to get a house to live in. I mean, there's all the life things that go into it.
Yeah, sure.
Then you've got to learn the playbook, and guys learn at different levels. There's some guys that are hard learners. There's some guy and there's a need to quickly identify a guy as a bust or a guy as a success. But you got to give the kids, like the kids, the younger players, you know, 2-3 years before you really get a sense of where they're going. We talked about it earlier. Who has the character? Who has the work ethic? Who's listening to the coaches? Who's getting better every day? And you'll see guys pop in year two that you thought, oh, that guy wasn't going to be any good. And then you see other guys regress because, you know, the league catches up with them.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. And like, yeah, you're as much as you're a football coach. And then you have like, you got to manage the different pieces too. You know, your different coaches, the different players. I'm sure it's a lot to handle. Was it overwhelming at times for you, and how did you deal with all the moving pieces?
You know, that's one of the things that probably made the decision to go away from investment banking so attractive, is because football did offer a lot of different things. When you have the team, but then you've got all the other parts that come into your world, whether it's PR, the training staff, the scouting staff, the equipment staff, operations, that they're all part of the organization, the family, and your decisions affect them. I'd say one of the hardest things for me was you care about people and you have relationships with people, but then you've got to make decisions for the greater good. And sometimes you got to tell people that you really like that it's over for them at the place that they're in. And I'd say that was probably the worst part of it. And you really had to sit back and try to see the world through everybody else's lens and see it through a big picture, and then convey that to people that maybe weren't open to it. You know,
yeah,
that was challenging too.
Yeah, no, I couldn't imagine. It's got to be a tough one. So I think we'll wrap it up there. That's going to conclude today's episode of Professions of a Market Maker. If you guys enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review it for us. If you'd like to join a supportive professional group of traders, you can join JJ and I at microefutures.com. Coach, let the listeners know where they can find you and anything else you want them to know.
I'm typically on FS1 on the shows there. You know, do some work with companies from a training perspective, if there's interest there. But my base is Fox, so that's where you can find me most often.
Go tune in, watch him on Fox. He's always giving the sound advice. You know, some of the other guys, I don't know what they're talking about sometimes, but coach is giving you the real info. You know, the perspective of a head coach. JJ, parting words.
Well, coach, I gotta say this. My best friend Mooner, who was our center, he is the most diehard Jets fan up here in Canada.
Okay.
And takes so much grief for it. So I just wanted you to, from him to you, just to say hi, because if he'd kill me if I didn't mention
and his name is what?
We call him Mooner because he was our center, and he's got this big chubby face that looks like a moon. So that's what one of the coaches called him back in high school, and it stuck.
Well, Mooner, I can relate to having a chubby face, so I feel you there, and I appreciate all the support that you've given the team over the years. I love the Jets fans. That they're passionate, they're smart, and they're going to hold you accountable. And I'm sure Mooner's the same way.
He is.
All right. Shout out to the Jet fans. Love to see it, man.
Exactly.
All right. So for Coach, Paulie Walnuts, he's the gorilla of House Street. You stop, so.